This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Frances Moore LePay. Frances is author of 18 books, including Diet for a Small Planet. She is the co-founder of three organizations, including Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, and the Small Planet Institute, and is a recipient of the Right Livelihood Prize and the James Beard Foundation's Humanitarian of the Year Award. Frances Moore LePay is here today to tell us about her most recent book, EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want, published in 2011. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Diane.
What led you to write your book, EcoMind?
Well, I walked out of a conference on the environment several years ago after being just loaded with all sorts of expert information, and I felt absolutely paralyzed. I just felt leaden by the weight of it all. And I thought, oh my God, if I feel so paralyzed, there's a real problem, because I want to feel energized. Is there a way that we can begin to think about the environmental crisis and all the other crises we're facing worldwide in a way that is compelling and that makes us want to jump in and be problem solvers ourselves? And that was the beginning of this book. I said, wait, there's got to be another way. As you know, the book is organized by seven thought traps and seven thought leaps. So I try to take the core messages around the challenges facing us and reframe them in a way that is grounded in evidence, grounded in everything we can know about ourselves, and is energizing. Yeah.
In what ways is our current frame of reference and the way we think leading us astray in addressing environmental issues?
Well, the basic theme of my work, and this began when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, the basic theme is that we human beings create the world according to the ideas we have, the big belief system. I call them the mental map. And the dominant, the prevailing one that we absorb unthinkingly, I think of as the scarcity mind. There's not enough of anything. Oh, there's not enough energy. There's not enough food. There's not enough, you know, government revenues today, right? Nothing. And I contrast that with the eco mind, which sees everything in connection, everything changing, and sees that actually, as we align with nature, which we're knowing how to do, then there is plenty for all. So the scarcity mind, the real tragedy of the scarcity mind is that it ends up creating a world that none of us as individuals would ever choose. We actually create the experience of scarcity starting from the belief in it. And so the fundamental reframe of this book is from scarcity to possibility.
Before we go into more detail, would you give an overview of what you call the thought traps that are holding us back from addressing environmental issues in a more productive way?
Well, the first of my seven, the first three really have to do with the message that we get and we tell ourselves, oh my gosh, we've hit the limits of a finite planet. We've hit the limits and we're running out, right? We've run out, we run over. And actually, if we really look at the facts, we see that, wait a minute, what we're actually doing is waste and destruction. Not that we've hit the limits of the Earth, but that we've created ourselves an economic political system that takes the tremendous abundance and shrinks it. Very practically, what I mean is that conservatively, 55% of energy in the U.S. is wasted. I've read credible estimates up to 87% of our energy is wasted. You take a typical power plant, two-thirds of the potential energy going into it is wasted. And then we think about food. 40% of the U.S. food that comes out of the ground, good to eat, is wasted. So what I'm saying is we haven't hit the limits of a finite planet. We have disrupted. We haven't aligned with nature's rules. As we do, then there is plenty. And as aligning with nature means growing food in a way that actually enhances the soil and water, and it means eliminating waste, because in nature there is no waste.
Let's go into some more detail now. If you look at your first thought trap, that a no-growth economy is the answer to our environmental issues, what's wrong with this idea?
It's very much what I was getting at. I tried to collapse those first three, but yes, the first one is the idea that growth is the problem. And my take on that is that what does that tell us? It tells that what we've been doing is growth. when I'm arguing that what we've been doing is waste and destruction. If we call it growth, I mean, a lot of people like growth. I want my granddaughters to grow. I want my love to grow and my plants to grow. So grow is a good thing. If we call what we've been doing growth, that already sets us up to say, oh, I've got to give up something good. And for people who are unemployed, people who are hungry in this country, now more than one of eight of Americans are on food stamps, right? So if you say to those folks, oh, we've got to stop growing, it's a frightening message. And fear, we know. Fear does not motivate us to be problem solvers and to jump in. We close down. We become more materialistic. So that message of no growth really misses that what we really want is vital, flourishing communities, and just drop this whole language around growth, because actually, we're not growing. We're destroying and wasting.
Would you elaborate on the way of addressing this issue in a more productive way?
Well, one of the core leaps in the book is from what I call the limits frame. Oh my gosh, you know, we've used it all up. We're living in this scarce world. We're not enough for any of us. To an alignment. And maybe that sounds abstract. But what I'm saying is that we are learning now about human nature. We've learned so much now through the new neuroscience, as well as breakthroughs in archaeology and anthropology. What are human beings? We know a lot more about what brings out the best in us and the worst in us. And we know so much more now. The science of ecology really is my generation. You know, when I was born back in the 40s, nobody was talking about ecology. So it's new. We know how nature works. So to move from the fear scarcity mode, the fundamental key is aligning with human nature and nature. And so, for example, we humans, we're an organism like every other one in the environment, right? So we know that what brings out the best in humans is our societies where power is widely dispersed, where we all feel that we can step up and be part of the answer, where things are transparent as opposed to today. You know, we saw on Wall Street what happened with all the secrecy before the big crash. So transparency is key. And we also know that humans thrive when we're to stop the blame, and we experience mutual accountability, I call it. So whether it's nature out there or human nature, the theme of this book that is, I feel, for me, liberating and got me out of that paralysis that I felt after that conference is this idea that, oh, we know what to do. We know how to create the conditions that actually produce healthy food. We know that organic agriculture can actually more than feed the current population. We know what conditions bring out the best in human beings.
So we focused on the idea of scarcity overall as being a thought trap. Would you elaborate on some of the other thought traps that you speak about having to do with human nature?
Well, certainly key to the thought trap and the scarcity theme is the scarcity of goodness in human beings. Because as long as we believe that, as our culture sort of from television shows to advertising and on, tells us that we're just selfish little shoppers, you know, that we're materialistic, we're competitive, we're selfish. As long as we believe that, then we don't trust ourselves. We don't trust ourselves to do democracy, for example, you know, because what does democracy require? It requires that we think about what's going to work for the whole city, for the whole region, for the nation, for the world, and we start to try to figure out how our interests connect to others. That's what democracy is. But if we see ourselves as these selfish little shoppers, real democracy is out of the question. And without it, we can't solve any of our problems. So that's huge. So what I do is I take the evidence, and it's exciting evidence. That's my favorite chapter in the book in some ways. From, you know, when they look at our brains with the MRI scans and study how we evolved over eons in tribal societies, that we actually are soft-wired, I call it, for cooperation. We are the most cooperative species. We are soft-wired for empathy. In fact, you know, as we watch each other, neurons fire in our brains as if we were actually that other person. So we're that close. So we have, I argue, all the qualities we need to make this turn toward flourishing on our planet. What we need, I argue, is courage, because we're good enough. But we have to have the courage to separate enough from the dominant pack, if you will, the dominant tribe, to begin to change the rules. And that's another key chapter in the book about our whole attitude about rules, to change them so that they are fair, they welcome us in as problem solvers. And that's why I'm so excited about this fair city. I got to meet with the president of the city council, and I've been following some of the initiatives on the local food action initiative here in the city. And it's exactly what I'm talking about. of assuming the best in people, that people want to be part of the solution, connecting with local farmers, changing whatever zoning rules need to be changed to encourage urban agriculture, to make more and more of us actual producers rather than just consumers. So that's the approach that I call living democracy, that is actually aligned with human nature, this desire to be problem solvers.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Francis Moore LePay, author of the book EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. You've alluded a bit to this, but would you say more about the thought trap that it is too late and we're beyond the point of no return? So why bother?
Yeah, that's the most deadly, isn't it? I mean, that is the last thought trap 7. I hear that. I hear my friends say that. And absolutely, it is too late to avoid great loss. I mean, we are losing, I don't know, dozens of species every day. Suffering is increasing from climate chaos that is impacting people's lives right now, real time. But I argue it is not too late for life. And what I mean by that is that human beings are fundamentally, as I argue, we are problem solvers. Life loves life. Every organism, including the human organism, strives to flourish. And so what really deadens us, what kills us before our true demise, is that feeling of powerlessness. And the it's too late message, if it's not addressed in this deeper way, makes us feel powerless. I think of the miners in the terrible tragedy in Chile, the miners who were trapped, and when they got out, there are 33 of them who got out with their lives, but all but one of them is suffering, I understand, from great stress, post-traumatic stress. The one person who's not suffering, I learned, is the person who did the most to organize things, who got things done, who felt a sense of agency, a sense of power. And so what matters is whether human beings feel that they have a role in solutions. In other words, it's not the tragedy of climate change, the tragedy of hunger, that just makes us completely depressed and overwhelmed. It's not seeing where we can make a difference. As long as we feel like we're useful, we can make it. But right now, depression is a global pandemic because people don't see that. So I'm saying that in order to see our role in solutions, to keep that energy alive in us, that we have to have a vision of a kind of democracy. From here, I mentioned the Seattle Local Food Action Initiative as an example of this, but we have to be creating a democracy in which we have a role. And so the book then talks about examples of grassroots efforts from India, where villagers are involved in forest management groups, where they have control, they have power over the restoration of their forests, and forests are expanding in India. So all the way from that kind of example to the U.S., where people are working to get money out of control of our political system. And I talk about the state of Maine, for example, that 80% of the people have been elected without corporate money, and therefore they've been able to pass brilliant environmental legislation that have kept toxic materials out of that gorgeous state. So the it's too late can be a real powerlessness message when what we need now is empowerment.
Would you say more about the steps we can take to help promote democracy, particularly structural steps?
Well, I say to everyone I can nab that whatever else excites you, spend a little bit of time going to this root question of getting our democracy back. I call what we have now privately held government, because basically FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in 1938 warned us that when private power has more control than our democratic state, then we're in big, big trouble. So one way, one critical way I mentioned is clean elections. Now there are two bills, one in each House of Congress, called Fair Elections Now. That's also a website, Fair Elections Now. In Maine, just to give you a taste of what's possible with fair elections, Deb Simpson, my superhero, was a waitress, single mom, and high school education in the year 2000. Because of clean elections, all she needed to do to get on the ballot was to get $5 from 50 people. As a waitress, she could do that. And her friends saw leadership in her and just encouraged her. She's become a brilliant legislator, is now sitting on the Natural Resources Committee for the state of Maine. She served on other important committees. So this is a person whose light would never be shining, whose talents would never be gifted to that state and to our nation without fair opportunity to run, even if you don't have money. And so that is key. But I think that each of us, I believe, want to be problem solvers. So it's not just one issue, in other words, it's what opportunities you have, what excites you. Obviously, for me, starting with my first book, Diet for a Small Planet, my intuition was that food, because we all eat, right? And we all love to talk about food, and that food is such an entry point. And in this city, which is encouraging urban farming and gardening and farmers markets and local small farms, and I mean, that is an entry point for more and more people because it addresses all of the conditions that bring out the best in us, too. It disperses power. It's transparent. If we join a community-supported agriculture, for example, that's a perfect exemplar of mutual accountability because we are choosing to invest in a farmer before the growing season, and then we get back in return marvelous organic produce during the growing season. And those innovations are breaking us out of that idea that somehow the market works on its own without us and shows us that we can take direct action.
In several places in your book, you discuss how inequality in our society drives environmental destruction. Would you elaborate on that thought?
Well, yes. One of the most shocking statements I find shocking when I tell people this is inequality in the United States now is greater than India and many other countries in the global south. Well, let me just say that the environmental crisis in many ways is a symptom in the same way that inequality is a symptom of a delusion that we have that somehow a market system works on its own. So that what happens is that we've fallen for this idea that we can all benefit, including the poor, if we allow the market just to return wealth, to return wealth, to return wealth. I call it the one rule economy, highest return to existing wealth. And so we end up where Citigroup announced in 2005, their researchers at that big corporation, that we've arrived at plutonomy, they call it. It's not my term. It's Citigroup's term. And it means 1% control more wealth than the bottom 90% put together. And so that inequality then drives a focus on, first of all, people at the bottom who feel so excluded. Understandably, the rest of us, we use material possessions to try to fit in, to try to join the club, even though we're structured to be excluded when wealth is so highly concentrated. But the worst of it, I think, in that extreme inequality, that 1% of the top is able to, you know, hire the lobbyists and infuse the decision-making process itself of democracy with rules that protect it from registering the environmental damage that's being done and to get away with the environmental damage. A brilliant study at Harvard concluded that just in coal use alone, coal mining and use alone, it's a third of $1 trillion a year that we're all paying in that. And that then is directly connected to the degree of inequality, the wealth at the top that then infuses the political system, and all of that loss, all of that we're all suffering from the consequences, it's all hidden from us. It's all non-transparent. So there are many, many ways in which, of course, diet-wise, et cetera, that extreme inequality is hurting all of us.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Francis Moore LePay, author of the book EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. Would you now say more about what it means to think like an ecosystem? What is the overall approach of the EcoMind? You've alluded to it. But...
yeah, well, for me, it means sort of being always the two-year-old questioner, right? Why? Because, okay, what is ecology? It's a science of relationships. And the brilliant physiologist at Oxford, Dennis Nobles, it just says, in biological systems, there is no you know, privileged component telling the rest what to do. It is rather a system in which all components are interacting to shape every component in the system. So it's a way of seeing the world that gives us tremendous power because there is no top-down. We are all creating reality moment to moment. So it's the opposite of the scarcity mind when things are fixed and finished and done and we're all separate from one another. An eco mind sees everything connected. and down to, as I mentioned earlier, the neurons in our brains are connected. So think of the power that gives us, because everything we do, every expression on our face, every choice we make about what we purchase or how we live, and that is affecting others. So I argue that from an eco mind, the only choice we do not have is whether to change the world, because moment to moment we are creating this world. And so that gives us great sense of power and responsibility, but I like to emphasize the power part, that we know that somebody is always watching and we can't even predict the outcome. So as people begin to choose a local organic and begin to realize that small farmers are actually more efficient than big agribusiness operations and begin to selectively choose that, that then just ripples out. Fair trade, for example. Already fair trade, which is a fairly new concept, the idea of purchasing something, knowing that you're doing it in part because the person who produced it is getting a fair wage. Millions of people in the world are already benefiting from that, able to create secure, healthy communities around the world. Coffee, of course, fair trade coffee is the most well-known example of that. So the scarcity mind keeps us separate and fearful. The eco mind allows us to see connection and change. And another virtue of it, if we really inhabit the eco mind, where change is the only constant and where everything is in interaction, then we realize it is not possible to know what's possible. It is not. So even the phrase, it's too late. No. We have to withhold what I call be humble, in the sense that we can't predict. And so part of the it's not possible to know what's possible, the freedom of an eco mind for me is to keep a running checklist in my head of the things that most inspire me today that I would have said, no, that couldn't happen 20 years ago. And so today, as we think, well, what can I do? And then if that thought comes, oh, that's impossible, just say no. I can't predict what's possible. I'm going to go where I think my calling is, where I think that I'm drawn to sort of walk the path of the world I really want, not the path we're on.
If you look back over the last, say, 30 years, do you see progression towards an eco mind?
I see that we're walking in two directions, and it's not one. In some ways, the fear of the scarcity mind, I mean, that's how I began Diet for a Small Planet, trying to bust the idea that there's not enough food. That idea today, now with climate change, you hear it again and again, oh, we're running out of food because of climate change. Not true. Climate change is real. It's hurting a lot of people, but there's now about 30% more food for each of us than there was when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, and there are more hungry people. So many of us are still trapped in the scarcity mind and creating scarcity. However, when I think of the food movement today and I think of all the people engaged in very poor communities to wealthier suburbs, engaged in renewable agricultural ecology, if you will, agroecology they called it, from here to Africa to India, you know, I could not have believed that Niger, one of the poorest countries in the world, has regreened 12.5 million acres, small farmers nurturing 200 million trees and creating new food security. So from Africa to the northwest of the U.S., I couldn't have imagined the positive. So at a time when sort of there are these two very clear pathways, I wrote Eco Mind to show us that more and more of us can choose life by really seeing ourselves as part of the ecosystem.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope the book will do for other people what it's done for me from that moment I walked out of that conference feeling so incredibly depressed and therefore just stuck. My dream with this book, and this is written with other people, I put out a draft that I had on my website and I got, hundreds and hundreds of people weighing in. And so it's really been a group project, crowdsourced book. And in the process, it's given me so much more clarity on the power that I have and so much more energy and connected me with so many, many people. I was in Bellingham, here in Seattle, Hawaii. The governor has set food self-reliance as a goal for the whole state of Hawaii. He ran on that platform. So I'm hoping that it connects people with positive eco mind examples, because the book is full of stories, so that people will read the book and say, oh, I could do that. I could do that. And it's full also on our website, smallplanet.org. It has many resources where people can go wherever they are and find something exciting to connect to, because ultimately I think we are social creatures, as ecology tells us, and we've got to be connecting with people who are going to motivate us and inspire us and not sink into this global pandemic of depression That's the one luxury we cannot afford. So I guess in a nutshell, I'm just hoping that the reading of the book does something for the reader that writing the book did for me. And we see the power that our minds have.
What do you see as most promoting the development of the eco-mind?
Well, I always come back to my 26-year-old insight that still seems true, that for a lot of people, that food, because it is our daily connection with the earth, and we can make it conscious and see the impact on our own vitality and the people that we as family members cook for. And so it's so real, and it connects us with our neighbors. So certainly that is one pathway. But really, there is no one pathway. Whether you're an educator, whether you're a business person, you can look at from the eco mind, what are all the connections, all of my impacts? And for example, in Bellingham, on the energy question, at the speed of light, they went from green energy electricity of 0.6%. In 9 months, they got to 12% of electricity in Bellingham from green energy. So the connection there was with, okay, energy. The whole idea of what would it mean to think like an ecosystem which has no waste. An ecosystem, everything is food for something else. So how could I live with zero waste? What would that look like? And how can I take a step right now, even if the ultimate goal is distant? And there are many examples in the book about how waste can become food for another process. So I guess the eco mind really encourages one to trust that wherever you are in this broad social and environmental ecosystem, there are ways that you're touching everything, and that using our imaginations, but connecting with others, I underscore that, because the buddy system and really hanging out with people who are courageous and taking risks, we know that we'll become more that way. So finding people who are your heroes and holding them in your mind, like I told you about Deb Simpson, my former waitress hero. So she's an icon for me. I think, what did that take for a waitress to run for state office and win and then be reelected? And so we need to find those heroes and hold them in our minds constantly, because we model ourselves after them.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
We can do this. We can do this. We see incredible suffering and loss all around us. But just remember that the human species, it's not the big challenge that does us in. It's feeling futile. And if you're feeling futile in this moment, you don't have to. Because right here, especially in this community, there are just incredibly powerful things going on. So when you have those negative thoughts, just say, wait a minute, we can do this. Life loves life, and we've got nature on our side.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
I'm delighted to be here.
You have just been listening to Frances Moore LePay, author of the book Ecomind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want, published in 2011 by the Perseus Book Group. For more information, check on the web at www.smallplanet.org. Again, that's smallplanet.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matter sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.